Holy fuck, somebody take over here. The fucking host is fucked.
All right, folks, welcome to another edition of the Nomad Podcast.
My name is Mitch Maxine.
And as always, if you have any questions or comments, please leave them on the No Mind Podcast Facebook page, my personal Facebook page, or drop me an email at nomindpodcast2021@gmail.com. We've got the old crowd plus one. Hey, everybody, how's it going?
Hey.
Great.
All right, one at a time. Darren, welcome back, man. How you doing?
Great. Thanks for having me again. It seems like once again we've missed a couple weeks, and you miss this, and you look forward to it, and that's exactly what it is. I was looking forward to tonight again.
See, that's why I like having Darren on, because when Bob comes on, he doesn't sound like he enjoys it. On that note, Bob, welcome back.
I enjoy it, and I'm glad to be here, and I always wonder what rhetorical boulevards will be marching down today.
That was convincing.
Lenny, how you doing, brother?
All good, raring to go. Like everyone else, missed this one, and can't wait to get back into it again.
I just got to say, everybody sounds awesome tonight. We usually have a lot of sound issues, but everybody's levels sound good.
That fabulous.
May actually cut down on the amount of editing I have to do. And Rick Mullen's back. Rick's been with us on a couple of podcasts in the past, and here he is again. Rick, how you doing, man?
Thanks for the invite. Glad to be here, and it's always a pleasure to talk to you guys for a few hours and have a few jokes and a few...
Drinks. Good to see you, Richie. Good to have you there, brother.
Thanks, Darren. Well, good to hear from you.
Okay, guys, so tonight's topics. A few podcasts ago, we came up with an idea where we would have some of the panel come up with questions, and Bob added his turn a couple of podcasts ago. So Lenny volunteered to go next. So all of the talking points for tonight came from Lenny. So if you have any issues with him, please blame him. And Len, I appreciate you going to the trouble, man. I know how hard it is coming up with talking points for this thing. So thank you for taking the time.
You might be sorry you said that, because I got hundreds more.
Okay, so we're going to jump right into this. Oh, just once around the table, anything you want to say that we haven't already said, anybody?
Regarding this podcast or just in general?
Just in general.
No, I think there's so much to discuss tonight.
Okay, so like I said, all these talking points are from Lenny. Len, I really appreciate you taking the time. So let's just jump into the first one. So here we go. I'm just going to read them the way Lenny wrote them. So number one, we are all told that achieving a black belt is the beginning of your martial arts journey. However, on your journey to black belt, you've been intensely focused for years on so much kata, technique, sparring, etc. When you achieve Shodan, what's your motivation, or indeed the next step, that's as content challenging as what you've just been through? Is it really the beginning of your journey? That's a really... I wish I'd read these before. That's a really thought-provoking...
You did. Yo, you bastard.
Darren, no. I think you're right. Darren.
Yeah. I was actually going to say that myself, but then I thought, I'll let this...
No, that's a really, really good question. Is getting your black belt really the beginning of your journey? Who wants to take the first stab at it?
I can if you want.
Oh, okay, go ahead, Rick.
Getting your black belt is a step. I mean, it is a huge step at the time. People that are on this panel have been black belts for quite a while, gone through other black belt gradings, yada, yada, yada. They know that when you get your Shodan, it's not quite as hard as what you think it is, because there's other things coming that are as hard, if not harder. As far as it being the start of a journey, well, the thing is, like they say in the Dans and the Q belts, one's a Q and one's a Dan, sort of one's man and one's sort of a learner type thing. You start getting to the point where you finish things and you polish things. And I was thinking when I read this, I thought it was quite a good question. And I remember about a year and a half after I got my Shodan, Rick Doyle, you guys remember that went to Jushin, you know Rick. I'm doing Kaikyoko Shodan. And he makes this off-the-cuff comment, like Rick always did. He looks at me and goes, finally starting to get some focus in your techniques, man.
Hey, Lenny, that's our most basic cutter.
Yeah.
That is the basic cutter. But it took me a year and a half after I got my Shodan for him to be able to say, yeah, you're finally starting to get some focus in there. So you're still working on stuff. There's still stuff to learn. And as far as sparring goes, after I got my Shodan, I started sparring a little better. I think, you're still traveling. You're still learning. And it is a lifelong thing. It's not something that you learn and stop, or at least not something that I learned and stopped.
This really brings up a talking point that's always pissed me off. And I don't know if I want to go there yet. So, you know what? I'm just going to tuck that in my back pocket. I'll bring it up later. Anyone else want to take a shot at that question? Is your black belt really the beginning?
I want to preface this by saying, first of all, our style is a bit unique in that when you get your black belt, we consider you a teacher and are allowed to teach from then on. Whereas in a lot of the other traditional martial arts, you don't teach until third or fourth degree. We're talking judo, kendo, aikido. And so I just want to point that out for the sake of anybody who's out there listening from another martial art who might be thinking, what? First degree black belt teaching? Yeah, that's the way it is for us. So anyway, there's that. Second of all, it's kind of like a university course where up to black belt, you are learning by rote and you're repeating what you've been told. And then after black belt, you can start thinking on your own. You can start changing things. You can start actually, or you should start creatively thinking on your own about the things that you have been taught. But like I say, until black belt, you're just spewing it back the way it's supposed to be. And yeah, in that regard, Shodan is just the beginning. Now you're starting to think for yourself.
Yeah, I know it's almost a bit of a cliche to say, oh, it's the beginning of your journey. I've never looked at it like that. But I just, like, the motivation to continue, for me, reaching the black belt was nothing more than just a kind of milestone. So the motivation to continue on was just to continue learning. And I think Bob said a lot of what I was thinking in my head is that when you reach that level, it's almost now you can start interpreting things in your own way and adapting your own way and developing your own style. And especially when you start teaching, you start thinking on your own and thinking, okay, some of them techniques, I don't think they would work in this situation. How can I adapt it? And you kind of move on. So the challenge was to take everything you've learned there and apply it to kind of what you think is the best way to go. So it's moving forward. And then as you're going on, and once you've reached that stage, you're taking other people that have reached that stage and you're all making comparisons. Does this work? Does this work? What do you think is better? And all that kind of thing. And I think usually, generally speaking, up until black belt, you train at the same club. And once you reach black belt, you start kind of experimenting with other clubs. So again, that's your motivation. You start seeing other aspects of it that you never thought of. So that's my answer. That was my motivation for continuing on.
I got to go along with what Darren said. When I got my black belt, it was a big deal and yes, very exciting and a personal milestone and all that stuff. But my perspective has always been on, I enjoy the working out and the training more than I enjoy the trappings of the training. I never really cared that much. After about green belt, blue belt, rank just became a thing. It was a thing you had to go through. And we can talk for days about the pressure that I was under and how I reacted to that pressure going from rank to rank. But in broad spectrum perspectives, moving from rank to rank was really just, it was just another day at the office. It was a thing that happened, okay, fine, but it never really defined my training. And especially after I got my black belt, going from rank to rank after that, it couldn't have meant less to me. It was a thing and whatever. It doesn't affect my training. Whether I pass or fail a grading, it doesn't change the fact that I will test and that I will train and I'll continue to train. So in terms of getting your black belt, is it really the beginning of your journey? I really got to step off of that. It wasn't the beginning of my training. The beginning of my training was when I stepped into the dojo floor. The notion of, oh, once you reach black belt, then your training really starts. All that does is add to the mystique of having a black belt. And I think that mystique does more harm than good. I think it sucks people in a negative way about what it means to be a black belt. I don't really think it means all that much. I think it's just another stepping stone on your road through your training. So this whole mystique of the black belt, which this question kind of brings to the front of my mind, I kind of hate it and I kind of revile against it. I didn't mean to inspire such silence.
No, I'm trying to take it all in and thinking, geez, that was... It was almost like a negative sounding thing, but I understand what you're talking about.
It kind of is. I see so much evidence of a negative impact of what's perceived as a positive perspective on having a black belt. Black belt is this elevated perspective. Oh, once you're a black belt, then your training starts. Well... what am I doing? What am I jacking off up till then? Like, what does that mean? Does that mean my training from white through brown is just kindergarten and who fucking cares? It's not worth my time. Like,
you're starting to get some focus in your jacking off technique there.
Yeah, very good. But we all know black belt. We all know
I'm shooting for distance.
Yeah, there you go. We all know people that get their black belts and then kind of stop or fade away. But exactly. The black belt does start separating the people that want to treat karate training or martial arts training as a lifelong thing where, like Darren said, well, now you can expand. You can go to other clubs. I did not do that, but I continued working out.
Yeah, you can do that at brown belt too. You can do that at blue belt.
But I mean, a brown belt hasn't basically made that commitment to a lifelong thing because there's lots and lots and lots of brown belts that have dropped out.
Okay, but there's lots of black belts who have two.
There's a lot of shodans that have dropped out.
Exactly. So why the delineation at black belt? To say at black belt, it means you've committed to a lifelong thing. I can point, without even trying hard, I can come up with 20 black belts who quit after black belt. Yep. So I don't get...
There's one right over here.
Wow, yeah, but
and
Buck,
thank God, because he was awful.
For an awful long time.
Yeah. But
I had to do the right thing.
Okay, Lenny, you've been suspiciously
quiet.
No, I'm just taking it all in.
Question, my friend. Let's hear it. What do you got?
Everything that every one of you has said, I probably take most of what you have all said and agree with it. And I think it's probably the way it's been worded for people over the years. We were all told it's the beginning of your journey. And I think that's absolute nonsensical bullshit. Your focus changes. And it's the make or break. As you said, you just hit the nail on the head. How many showdowns we know got to black belt and kind of, yeah, that's it. Whereas if you really appreciate what you've gone through to attain the knowledge you have, it should inspire you to want to know more. I mean, I got my showdown grade, it was kind of, okay, I'm magically a black belt, but how good am I? And I need to know more. And that's what pushed me to kind of explore. Like Darren says, you go to different clubs. I've constantly looked to... learn more of different styles to improve myself and improve what I can pass on. And I think that side of it, it's not a beginning of a journey. It changes your focus. Okay, you mightn't be as physically pushed as you were to get to black belt. Like we all know on the night of a showdown grade, you're really, really pushed hard. From our point of view, with the style that we do, a lot of the clubs nowadays, and it really disappoints me, and as you said, we get into a whole different thing of second degree, third degree, you know, the pros and cons of whether they should exist or not. Most people hand them out ceremoniously now, so there's no real push beyond that. Whether you want to class it as a journey or class it as new focus, that's entirely up to the individual then. Are you going to jack it in or are you going to keep going?
But is it up to the individual? Isn't it more up to the instructor of the individual to define the perspective? Look, when you walk into a karate club for the first time, you have no experience in the martial arts, you basically surrender yourself to the instructor because that's the person who, from your naive, inexperienced perspective, they know. So isn't it more up to the instructor to define for their students how they're going to perceive a black belt? How many of us were weaned on what our instructor told us about what a black belt was? How are we as students coming up through the colored belt ranks supposed to perceive a black belt other than what we're spoon-fed by our instructor?
We kind of went through that in past podcasts where back in the day, you didn't have access to the internet and all that information. And especially if you grew up in a small town where there might only be one or two clubs or something like that. So you're kind of forced to respect and follow the direction of whoever you happen to be training under. So it's not the same today, but that's what it was back then.
I think it is the same today, and I'll tell you why. I think, Darren, you've got a very positive perspective on individual and their intellect and their ability to disseminate right from wrong and good from bad, and I don't. I think people are generally pretty stupid, and no matter how much good information is out there, they are willing to be led. I think most people are wanting to be led and wanting to be told. And if they've got someone standing directly in front of them telling them something, that's going to take priority for most people over what's available, over the real information that, yes, you're right, it's out there. But I don't think real information being out there impacts that many people on that.
Here's a question for you, Mitch. How many people get the show done and their instructor has a plan for them beyond that?
Oh, from my experience, none.
But that, and I think that's massively the point I was trying to make earlier. You get to what people perceive as the pinnacle, and you're told this is the beginning of the journey, and you're going, well, what is it? What am I supposed to do next? And there's no one there to say, well, hang on, guys, this is what you have to do next. It's not going to figure it out yourself.
Len, that's a brilliant point. Once you promote somebody, let's all put ourselves in the place of someone running a club, and we've all run clubs to the point, or at least been involved in clubs where people have been promoted to black belt. What responsibility do we or should we take for the education of those students once they pass the black belt level?
But it's like other sports too. I'm gonna say Peterborough, where we do hockey, and I've seen kids come up through hockey. The guys have come up through the club, and they're in hockey. They use karate to help their hand-eye coordination and yada yada. But I mean, it's like hockey. When you are in the junior ranks, you are coached really hard. When you're coming up through 13, 14, 15, up to 18 years old, you are coached really hard. You get into junior A, you're not coached as much, but they keep egging you on a little bit. That's brown belt. You're polishing. You get into the NHL, the coach doesn't really coach you. He coaches the team as to how they want them, the whole team, to play. He doesn't give you special instructions.
Okay.
Once you reach the black belt, it's like you are expected to sort of take over a little bit of that imperative to continue training. Now, I did, you did, I know Bob did, I know Darren did because we had to.
Right. We didn't have a choice. We weren't given a path once we got to black belt. But shouldn't we have been?
You were given hints to the path, and you had to find the path.
No.
It's the Matrix. We're entering the Matrix.
Oh my God! No, that gives
you
the instructors.
You were given a list of. No, I wasn't. You were given a list of kata that you had to be instructed, or you were showing.
Oh, please!
So you got black belt. Other than that, it's like, Mitch, it's the same thing. If you and I are working out, and you see me do something wrong, you'll come over and you won't do what you do to a green belt and say, "You idiot, you did that wrong." But you will say, "Rick, you screwed that up."
Yeah, but okay, fair enough, and you're right. But look, dude, you and I are talking from 35 years in the martial arts, and we see each other. What about someone who's fresh out of a black belt grading? Don't they still need guidance? Don't they still need some sort of focus?
Well, in our club, they still get a little guidance because we keep yelling at them. But I don't know about what. There's no path.
The other thing I think on this particular topic, like we're saying it didn't happen. We're all basing it kind of on the same club that three of us were reared in. So that's like to say this is what happens when you're a black belt and is the instructor. Like I think the question Mitch was asking was, what is the responsibility of, say, the head instructor to ensure that there is a path to follow when you get that? So we can all sit back and go, we never had this and we never had that. But that's obviously not the same for thousands of other dojos. So in this aspect, I think we fixed the question, is it the responsibility of the head instructor to do
that?
But
as Bob said in other styles, there's a syllabus that says, okay, you need to do this to get second, this to get third, this to get fourth. And we, in our style, don't have that.
But I'm not willing to say it's just our club.
There's lots of clubs.
Our environment, this whole Southern Ontario environment that we're reasonably well connected into, I don't see much in terms of guidance or syllabus or criteria for advancement past Shodan. What's the syllabus? What do you have to do to get your seventh degree? And maybe that's taking it one.
First, you got to get your sixth.
You got to levitate.
First, you got to get your sixth. We're only fifth.
But I want to go once around the table. I'm curious what everyone thinks about this. Once someone achieves their black belt, are they then expected to take control of their own path forward? Or is there some responsibility on their instructor to give them some guidance, Bob?
I don't think it matters either way, as long as it's explicitly stated to the person, or it's a policy in the club. As long as you lay it down and say this is what to do or what not to do, then that's fine for that club.
I think this should be instilled as you're going through the ranks. What you're talking about is a path after you reach black belt. I think that should already be established as you're going through the ranks. So when you do reach black belt, you already know where you're going in general after that. So it's not suddenly, okay, where do I go from here? I've achieved this monumental thing. What do I do now? I think it should all be explained as you grow up. Not grow up, but go through the ranks. So it is the head instructor's responsibility. By the time you reach black belt, you should know exactly what you want to do after that.
That's really interesting. Man, I really want to explore this. Rick, what do you think?
I was just listening to Darren, and it occurred to me that as you're coming up through the ranks, the black belt is portrayed by other people in the club and by the head instructor as a target. So don't you want to get your black belt? Are you going over your black belt? You go through your green, your blue, your brown, and then after so many times or so many years or whatever, you get your black belt. But it's never really explored, like Darren said, it's never really explored what happens after. There is that sort of disconnect, as once you get your black belt, it's like, well, okay, it's up to you. What do you want to do? When you're a Shodan for the first year or couple of years, it's like, well, I don't know. Right now, my aim is to continue working out for the next 5 years if possible. But I mean, just, you know,
well,
working
out
is...
Our goals shift as we get older, man.
Yeah, exactly.
I hope I can get up in the morning.
Yeah, I hope so too.
I've got another question, but Len, what do you think?
I think it is 100% the responsibility of the head instructor to have goals after it. Because at the end of the day, you were their instructor all the way through. You've guided them all the way to Shodan, and it's not just a case of cutting them loose. Now, yes, they have to have a scope to fly their wings and explore for themselves. But if they're staying in your club and want to be part of your club, you have to have a target. Otherwise, you're just going to get bored. Like, a lot of places, the only requirement after you hit Shodan is, okay, now you have to teach. And the guys are going, ugh, I'm still teaching beginners.
Question, Lenny.
Yeah.
In your club, once you promote a brown belt to a Shodan,
what?
Give us an example. What are your
after
expectations?
After that, they're then given their goals for their second degree if they wish to proceed it. And second and third degrees, as far as I'll promote, if I'm going that far after that, there isn't a syllabus as such. But I mean, for you get your second degree, there's an extra two classes, which is fair enough. They're fairly physical ones, so you want to keep your physical fitness up and your physical involvement. You also have to come up with a small syllabus of your own of so many punches, kicks, so on and so forth, and they have to be practically based. And you also must bring someone from, this is the long path, you've got to bring someone from beginner to black belt along the road.
What do you mean?
Sorry, yeah, I was about to say, I'm not sure what that means, Len. Yeah.
You've got to be responsible. If somebody walks in the door and he's a beginner with you and he does a couple of cue belts, you know, okay, there's a good prospect of this guy going all the way to black belt. I'll say to one of my Shodans, you are responsible for keeping their standards up, and you are responsible for when they'll grade, and you are responsible for the standard they'll present with on each grade. And if you can stand over that and present them eventually to me for their Shodan black belt, then you'll get your second degree.
I got a question for you, Lenny, based on that.
Yeah.
My head instructor came up to me at one point. I think I was a Shodan, and we had a kid who was a blue belt, and he was a bit of a problem child, more just in terms of his attitude. And he said to me, this is after class, we're at his place and having a couple of drinks. And he said, look,
that
I'm going to...
That never happened.
I know. He said, I'm going to put you in charge of this kid. And I said to him, and this is one of the first times I actually stood in opposition to something he told me. And I said, I don't accept that responsibility. And he looked at me and said, what are you talking about? I just told you I want you to do this. And I said, you're not willing to give me the authority that I need to do what I think I should do. And he said, what are you talking about? I said, if you honestly are giving me responsibility for the student, the first thing I would do is demote him to a lower rank. Mm-hmm. I don't think he deserves the rank he has. And he goes, oh no, you can't do that. And I'm, there you go. You're asking me to take responsibility for this student, but you're not giving me the authority that I need to do the things I need to do. that ended that conversation. So when you say that you give your black belt responsibility over Q belt, exactly how much authority do you give him?
Good question.
Thank you.
Well, I think, and this is probably a very self-indulgent sounding answer, I think my black belts, because I've brought them all the way through myself, kind of echo my standards to 99%.
Except for that one guy you were having problems with.
Yeah, and just turned out that was all earned out in the end, and I'll fill you in that another day. But yeah, I mean, I think that most of my black belts are mostly guys that I would give responsibility to. Probably won't differ from my vein of thinking, so I'd be more than willing to hand them full responsibility. But maybe I'm just unique in that respect.
So, if okay, Len, I'm sorry, I don't want to gang up on you, but I'm really.
She did it in the last podcast. What's new?
Good point.
I'm a
carrying
big boy.
On. If you gave responsibility to one of your black belts for a Q belt, and that Q belt was promoted, and then 2 months later, that black belt came to you and said, "You know what, this guy, for all these various reasons, I think I want to demote him to his." To the rank below where he is now. Is that something you would be okay with?
Provided I agree with him, yeah. And if I didn't agree... No, wait, let me finish.
Sorry, that's a question.
Such a politician's answer. But I would then go, firstly, and have a chat with the student in question, say, let's have a look at his standards, and give him a short time frame, say, okay, if the advice I was given was fairly valid, you just got to have it out and say, look, your standards have slipped, you're going to test again for the grade you're on now in a few weeks, and if you don't pass that, you're busted back down. Simple as that. Yeah, and that it goes back to what you asked me, Mitch, that if he came to me and said this guy needs to be demoted, okay, let's see, and if you can't do it, I'm sorry, pal.
But
you talk to him and say, okay, I'm giving you 2 weeks notice, you got to either.
Yeah. But doesn't that? But if you say to a black belt, look, I'm going to put you in charge of this Q belt, you're responsible for their progress, and then they say to you, look, I'm going to do this, and then you go, oh, hold on, I'm going to go check on whether that's the right thing to do. Doesn't that make their authority kind of impotent?
Not necessarily, because the student involved, you would have been monitoring their progress anyway, so it shouldn't be any great surprise if the black belt comes to you and said, listen, this guy's taking the piss. You should be well aware of your student standards, and if this guy says it to you, well, you go, yeah, I actually agree with you. It probably.
Okay, guys, we've been on this topic for almost 40 minutes.
I was just going to say that, and I'm not even the host.
I better
take
keep
over,
up. Exactly, you guys, there's going to be a coup. Okay, let's go once around the table. 15, 20 seconds, that's it on this topic. Bob, go.
Holy moly, I think we well covered it and gone way beyond. I'm fine holding it to 20 seconds. Next.
One thing that I was thinking about, like to the actual question about the achievement of a black belt, and this is going to take more than 20 seconds, but I think it depends on the club. And if you happen to be the first black belt in the club, I don't know what you're going to achieve after that, other than trying to be as good as the head instructor. I had the benefit that when I reached the black belt, this is kind of kudos to everybody on this podcast at the moment. There was so many people that were so far above me that me just reaching that milestone it was just a milestone. I still had so much more to try to inspire to and to achieve to because of everybody that was there ahead of me that were still training. And even now, like, 30 on years, Lenny still does stuff that I go up there and go, fuck, I never thought of that. Like, I haven't seen that before. So it just keeps going and going and going.
Rick.
I wouldn't say that it's the start of your journey. Yeah, I think that's something that's said to Q belts to sort of give them the idea that, okay, once you get to a black belt, you know, now you can start learning really good stuff. I don't know whether it's a carrot or a stick. I'm not quite sure. I haven't quite decided. But the step from brown belt to Shodan is a big step. It's a huge step. But it's you never stop learning. I mean, you've learned for however many years you were a Q belt, 3 to 6 years, whatever it was. And then, like, I'm still learning 40-odd, 50-odd years later. I mean, it's still you're still learning. So it's like there is no end to this journey. It started when, like you said, when you walked in the dojo and got on that dojo floor. And for some of us and most of the people on this panel, I would say are them, it's a lifelong thing.
I'm going to throw my two cents in. Len, you'll get the last word because it's your question. But my perspective is, I think way too much emphasis is put on achieving rank and not enough emphasis is put on consistent training. I think way too much emphasis is put on, ooh, it's your next grading, time to get ready for it. I think that the perspective should be, you can be graded at any moment or tested at any moment. I don't like this notion of there's a grading coming up. It's time to get ready. I don't like that. I think it puts too much emphasis on the notion of progression by the color of your belt instead of progression by what you're actually learning. And I think a lot of people get caught up in that. And especially it's dangled like a carrot in front of your nose. Here's your black belt. Well, ooh, I got to get ready for my black belt. How about we just train in a certain direction, and once you're ready, you'll get your belt. I'm really starting to think, largely as a result of these podcasts, that the whole ranking system needs to be revamped. In a nutshell, that's it. Lenny, finish us off.
I think it's endemic on the instructor, head instructor in the club, that if you're going to make this statement that you get the black belt, that's only the beginning of the journey, you've got to have a plan in place. Always, always try to inspire your students beyond that. You know, everybody says the black belt is the pinnacle, and you're going to say then it's not, there's something else. Make sure you have a bloody good plan in place to show them what's out there.
I really agree with Lenny. I think it's incumbent on the instructor to make sure they've got a plan, especially for the younger black belts, in terms of how they're going to progress. Okay, we're going to take our traditional pause. We'll be back in a couple of minutes. All right, we're pausing.
Quick pause.
Okay, folks, we're back from the break. We're on to talking point number two. This is an interesting one because Darren and I attended a tournament barely a month ago. So here we go. So refereeing standards in tournaments. What are your thoughts on what seems to be a globally controversial subject? Nepotism, cronyism, and general non-consistent standards of judging and refereeing seem to sully more and more tournaments. How do we tackle and rectify this?
What strikes me is that it was exactly the same when I was back in the scene a decade or two ago. It's very sad that exactly the same situation obtains. And so I'm looking forward to you guys' solution to all this.
Bob, quick question. Back in the day, like you said, when you were in the scene, you weren't with our group. You weren't doing karate. So you were doing
Aikido? Before that. Before that, I was doing karate.
Oh, I mean, but you've got experience with Aikido and Judo. Are you saying the same sort of thing happens with them?
Not at all. Never experienced that anywhere. And I've been to some Kendo tournaments and Judo tournaments, and there's none of that business.
That's interesting.
Here, I can tell you exactly what the problem is right now. The two things, like if you watch loads of UFC fights, you'll have everybody agreeing on who won and the judges agree on somebody else winning. And all they do is talk about for days and days about how the judging has to be changed. So it's not limited to just karate. It's not limited to Ontario. It's a worldwide thing. And technically, it can't really be changed. It can be changed in the sense of boxing or MMA because they can make stringent criteria and training courses to show you where people get points and why. And that's how you determine a winner. My experience in a lot of tournaments, the tournaments end up being far bigger than the amount of qualified referees or judges at the tournament. So you have a black belt meeting. A lot of them aren't actually capable of refereeing or judging, but you need them because of the sheer size of the tournament. And there's no way, unfortunately, to fix that, because if you're short a judge, you have to grab a black belt, regardless of whether he's qualified. And I've seen that so many times, you end up with some complete fool that either only just got their black belt or has had it, but they don't deserve it, or they just don't understand judging or refereeing. It's not just because you have a black belt doesn't mean you're qualified to judge or referee. It's a totally different aspect. It's like being a coach or a trainer. You don't have to be the best in the world to coach or train. You just have to be good at coaching or training. And that's the same with judging.
That's an excellent point. I think you're really right about that. What you're saying, like, that harkens back to the first talking point. Like, once you get your black belt, you're just thrown into a refereeing position or a judging position. And but what you're saying, Darren, is the solution might be to have mandatory courses for refereeing and judging.
I think 100%. As you're going through the ranks, and now in fairness, now we used to do it. You'd be forced to judge or not judge, but you'd be forced to referee, say as a blue belt maybe or something like that, just to get a bit of experience. But nobody actually tells you what you're looking for and why. In my experience, anyway, you're just thrown into the position, but nobody actually trained you or told you.
We've now split this conversation into two separate conversations. One is the technical ability to competently judge, and the other is more specific to Lenny's talking point, which is nepotism and cronyism and consistent standards of judging.
I think they go hand in glove, though.
I don't think they do.
I agree with Mitch. They're separate. I've run our tournament that we have, and I have now for, I don't know, 10, 15 years, whatever. And my biggest problem is trying to get good high-level black belts to judge other black belts, because I don't want a brand new Shodan going up and judging Mitch or Bob, or Darren or something. They don't have the experience. They haven't had any training, probably, and they don't have the experience. So it's hard to get five judges that are high enough that can judge other lower, well, not lower, but higher black belts.
Yeah.
It's not only a rank issue. I've been asked to judge weapons kata, and I've said, I'm sorry, I don't feel qualified. I don't train in weapons. I don't enjoy weapons. I will do it if you've got no one else, because I know you need a minimum number of judges. So there's the qualification of the individual. In terms of judging a tournament, I don't think anybody who didn't actively or hasn't actively competed has any business being a center ref at a tournament.
Absolutely.
Forget about corners for a second. Corners,
they shouldn't even be corners.
But we need to be a little bit reasonable in terms of how many black belts we have. Maybe this impacts what I'm about to say, but look, if someone doesn't actively spar, please don't center ref. You don't understand the subtlety of sparring. You don't fight. You don't know the detail behind what goes into a fight.
Or hasn't at least sparred in the past.
I don't think that's enough. I honestly don't.
Really?
Look, someone who sparred a couple of times as a brown belt wants to be a center ref as a black? No.
I was speaking of myself entirely, but anyway.
No, but you've sparred consistently at the black belt level. You have that background. I don't think people who do not have that background should be allowed to center ref. And all the classes and all the courses in the world are not going to give you that experience. I'm not saying that classes and ref courses aren't important. I just don't think they're enough.
I didn't mean a separate course. I just meant part of your curriculum going through the ranks.
Having a referee course is fantastic. It just gives you the basic things of And it's someone else's attitude is like, all right, and they give you examples. You see this guy doing this, and you see this guy doing that. Okay, this guy actually scored the point before this guy did this kick to the head. Our club was really good at reverse punches. So we'd be up against somebody, and they'd throw this high kick. Well, the high kick would miss, and our guy or whoever would throw a reverse punch right to the solar plex, but the guy that threw the kick would get the point.
That feeds back into the experience as a tournament fighter. I get why someone might call that high kick. It's bigger, it's flashier, it's more obvious. You don't get to recognize those things if you haven't got that level of experience.
In some respects, at certain levels, you may solve this, but I don't think this will ever be solved. In some respects, at certain levels, you can somewhat solve this, but at the main grassroots level, you're never going to solve it. Darren's talking about refereeing courses, and they have that here in that they brought up a body years ago called ONACOI, which is the Organization of National Amateur Karate Associations of Ireland. And basically tried to have a set standard of rules and a set refereeing standard. And you had to have a proven track record in competing and had to be at least Shodan to go on the refereeing course. If you weren't both of these, you could not referee at a tournament full stop. And those tournaments are organized so many times a year, and they're pretty high standard, and it's very good. That being said, then you go to grassroots, me, Blessing Kempo Club. I want to put a tournament on with a couple of other clubs, or we invite you guys over and so on. And we all arrive in the night before the tournament. We go, okay, who have we got here? How many referees do we need? You look after that ring. You look after this ring. That's where the problem starts to filter down. Myself and Darren were in the UK a few years ago, and Darren nearly came to punches with the head organizer the night before the tournament over his perception, because In fairness, Darren was totally right, because the guy said, if I'm the centre ref, I have arbitration to overrule everybody else. And Darren said, well, what's the bloody point in having corner refs if you decide? And this guy said, no, centre ref is God. And it all boils back to ego and accountability. That goes hand in fist with, I'm putting on a tournament, we're going to win, my club's going to win, and you have jobs for the boys. And on those small grassroots level, you're never going to beat that. Whereas
I got to jump in here for a second. I was weaned on the tournaments in the 70s, and Bob, and maybe, I don't know, maybe 80s. you guys won't remember this. Oh, right. Yeah, the 70s. Wait, I didn't 80s. Start till 80. Wait a sec. Yes, I was 20s. Weaned in the 20s.
Yeah, wait, okay.
Sorry. The tournaments I remember going to was on the tail end of the center ref has all that authority. And I'm going to be honest, I think that the center ref should have that authority. Good center refs, and they run the ring. This is a big deal with me.
Well, then why have corner refs at all?
I'm not saying the center ref doesn't take the corner refs perspectives into account. I think the center ref, if you're it's all about the integrity of who you have as a center ref, because the part of your talking point was, how do we tackle and rectify this? This is how we do it. You put someone in the center ref position who has integrity and is good, and he calls everybody else on their bullshit. If someone makes a call that is obviously wrong, and here's one of the, just to give you an example, every time I'm a center ref and I run a ring, one of the things I say is, when I call a point, whip that flag up immediately. If you're even half a second behind me,
yeah,
I'm not gonna count it.
Yeah.
And I don't. And if I see, now I don't catch it all the time because you have to look around in a certain direction. You can't see all around you. But if I see someone throw a flag up slow, I'm going to say, not counting that point. I don't care what it does to the score. That flag didn't go up in time. I'm not counting it. The only way to rectify nepotism and cronyism is when we see it happen, we call it in the moment, and we discount it. And I don't even know if that's possible. But I see it so often. That's what I boil back to saying about
accountability.
Yeah, Mitch, I don't think that's where Lenny was going. I think he was talking about the center referee calling a point all on his own. Now,
overruling the other people, yeah.
Or overruling all the other ones. Our center referees cannot call a point on their own or overrule 4 points.
They can
if it's contact.
Yes. That's
or
my
it's
point.
Unsportsmanlike conduct type thing.
That's what I was going to say.
If the center referee says, I see red, and 4 fucking flags go up, they all see
right.
White. The center referee goes,
I agree with that. I agree that if...
Yeah, that's fine.
In terms of calling points...
Yes.
I as a center ref, and I've center refed a lot, I would never overrule...
But what Lenny's talking about is the center referee goes, nope, I saw the red, so I gave red a point.
Fair enough. Okay,
like,
fair
oh,
enough.
No, nobody's nobody's ever done that.
No, they haven't. That was the scenario that was being brought up when we were in the UK.
And
at the time.
Fair enough.
I was just using that as an example that, you know...
My point being, though, that as the center ref, I have way more... a far better view of what's going on than the corner refs do.
Yeah.
So look, I would never overrule the corner refs on a point.
No.
I will overrule the corner refs on contact.
Yeah, absolutely.
If I see contact and they call point, that I will overrule them on.
Yep.
And I don't even know if that's a good thing. What do you guys think about that? Is that okay?
I'll jump in because it's always, if there's not a proper, not necessarily training, but a curriculum that says this is exactly what we're looking for. Because I've seen things where it goes both ways. I don't think it was excessive contact, but the center judge overruled it. And then I'm like, well, why are you the center judge? Because we're the same rank. I saw something different. Who decides? Just because you're the center ref doesn't mean
it's
because you're not, your job was not a center ref before going into that. You just kind of got that position because there was a lack of people at the tournament, or you agreed to do it, or the rest of us didn't want to do it. Not you specifically. I just mean whoever center ref.
I get it.
A lot of the time,
Again,
so it's just,
everybody here has attended a lot of tournaments where they have a black belt meeting at the beginning of the tournament, and they lay down the rules, and then the rules are not followed by the center ref. And,
exactly. And then they don't follow them.
Exactly.
It's one of the most frustrating things in the entire
Oh, my God.
So, hang on a second. Lenny's talking point's fucked because it has like nine different things in it. It's got like nine different topics in it. So
I'm sorry.
It's That's a great cool. topic.
That's excellent.
Let's talk about one particular point because this is something that I'm quite adamant about. It's the center ref's authority. The only reason I think the center ref should have autonomous authority over his ring is because the corner refs are limited in where they're allowed to be in the ring. And when I center ref, I'm flip-flopping all over the goddamn ring because it's my job to make sure I can get the best view of the fight. The center refs aren't allowed to do, or the corner refs are not allowed to do that. No. They've got to stay in their corners within reason, that limits what they can see. Yep. So like I said, I would never overrule my corner refs on a point. If I don't see a point, but four of them do, I'm like, it's all good.
Or point, if you see whatever. The other point, doesn't matter.
Exactly. The point being, though, there are circumstances where I think the center ref should have control and should be required to control their ring. And what I'm seeing more and more of as the tournaments go on are center refs who, either because of lack of experience or because they're being castrated by the rules of the tournament, have less and less control. And I'm not sure that's a good thing.
I'm going back to the old days, and I'm sure it's the same now, where you get center refs who think they're kings of the world and can overrule everything, and they say screw it to that black belt meeting at the beginning of the tournament, and they allow contact when there's not supposed to be, or they don't allow contact where they're supposed to be, and that's that's a big problem.
Let's look at the consistent standards of judging. I think that's probably the bigger issue because exactly like Bob said, you've got center refs whose egos are bigger than their intellects and they just want to be in charge and screw the rules of the tournament and I'm going to do what I want to do, and it leads to an inconsistent standard of judging. How do you combat that? Isn't that what the head arbitrator is for? Have you guys ever seen a circumstance at a tournament where a head arbiterator was actually called to a ring arbitrate something?
I have not. Many times. I've been head arbitrator for our tournaments for 10 years.
Yeah, but
I've
never.
I'd like to say more. Have I ever seen a tournament with a head arbitrator, bar two? And that's how sad it is here.
I'm always head arbitrator for ours, so.
Rick, were you called out even once at the Jushin tournament a month ago?
Nope.
Should you have been?
Probably twice.
I'm gonna go out on a limb and say way more than twice.
Probably twice. Well, what I've seen, what I saw, and what I saw in films, yes, I should have been called out at least twice. Once especially, but hey, we're not going to go into that one.
Why?
Because it involved you.
Uh-oh, what did I do? Fuck, who did I hit?
Did I hurt someone?
Not what you did.
I hurt somebody, didn't I? God damn it.
What happened to you?
Wait, hang on. Darren, you were trying to say something. What were you trying to say?
Oh, jeez, I can't remember now.
Ah, fuck.
Sorry.
Okay, let's
There's
go
no
once.
There's no solution to this, is there?
But there is. There is.
Kind of getting to.
Put competent people in charge and hold people accountable. God damn it.
The thing is, the last kind of question on Lenny's topic said, how do we tackle or rectify this? And I think this, you have to start at the bottom and educate everybody all the way up. So by the time you're a referee, you know exactly what's going on. It's all about education, kind of through the thing. You can't just grab someone and go, here, you're reffing. It's like, well, I don't know. I don't like that guy, or I don't do this, or I believe in full contact. No, if everybody's educated, you have to start. It's not going to be something that's going to be tackled in the next year. It's all the people coming up for the future that are going to be referees and judges. They have to know properly how to do it.
Okay, we're going to go once around the table talking about refereeing standards. How do we fix it? Bob, go.
The best way to fix this problem, and I've just realized this, is for more people to listen to this podcast and realize... Yes. what the problem is.
Exactly.
And come to sudden realizations that they've been making a mistake all these years, and they will they'll darn well turn around their lives,
and there won't,
and
be,
there won't any, be any problems refereeing anymore.
Because these five guys know what they're talking about.
God damn it. Fixing the karate universe one podcast at a time. Okay, Rick, 20 seconds, go.
I don't know. You can't fix what's that broken. I mean, people will put referees in that they like. I do. I mean, I run my tournament, and I put people in that I know run the run their rings the way Mitch and me and John like the way the ring is run. So it's like, that's what I do. And it's like, the only problem I have is getting black belts to judge black belts, because I want higher black belts judging black belts. I don't know. Courses would help, but experience is a big thing. And if you don't get Shodans and Nidans going in and competing as Shodans and Nidans, they don't get the experience of being judged so that they can judge later.
Darren.
I think I already said it's about educating on the way up. So by the time you're in a position to be a judge, you've been educated and you should know how it goes. But even on that, like I was just thinking about the last tournament I was at, and I've done center refereeing many times over the years. I'm well capable. I know what it's all about. But I would rather forego center refereeing and be a corner ref in a ring where I respect the center ref. And that's why when you were putting together your ring, Mitch, and you said, did I want to go? I'm like, yeah.
Absolutely.
And then John came up to me and John said, here, I need you to do this ring. And I'm like, no, I'm already in Mitch's ring. And he's like, well, I need a head ref. And I'm like, no, I'm already done in this ring. Because I didn't want to be a head ref and have to do the whole responsibility thing and everything and have four morons that I may or may not know or trust behind me. Because I knew Mitch was putting together something good. So I thought, I just want to be part of that. Because I know the entire day is going to be run properly. Whereas if I'm the head ref, I got to deal with everybody else, and I don't know these guys because I haven't trained in Ontario for so long. It was just like, no, I don't want to deal with that. I want to go where I know it's going to be run properly, and it just goes like that. So I don't think there's an easy fix. It's going to take a long time.
Darren, as an aside, thanks for coming. You were fantastic, and appreciate you being there.
I had a great time.
Okay, Lenny.
Yeah, exactly what Darren said. It's education on the way up. You got it. Basically, if you can't educate them, if you can't get them out, you have to breed them out. Basically, that's the philosophy.
Breed them out.
Oh my god.
No, and
my god.
I'm introducing Prima Nocta.
That's what I was alluding to.
We're going to breed him out.
Lenny's quoting Braveheart at this point.
Yeah, if you can start at grassroots and bring it up through that, by the time they come through with it.
If I can't fight them out, I'll breed them out.
Okay. So you're saying we should start training them, what, at Blue Brown? We do that. I mean, at our club, we'll get brown belts.
No, I think you start from day one.
No, we throw them in, but we don't actually tell them what they're looking for.
Yeah,
and
we
why.
Don't throw them in, no. But we don't throw them in at a tournament. We throw them in at a something we're doing at the club, and we introduce them to, all right, this is what you're looking for. Where's the point?
Yes.
So educate them early.
Yes.
I think it's a two-pronged solution. One is education early. I agree with that. But the second is people in charge being willing to hold other black belts accountable, and I think that's a huge problem. I think
we did say accountability was a whole podcast session on its own.
It is.
How would never mind. I was going to say how would one do that? I'm not even going to ask questions.
Next time. All right, let's get on to the next talking point. Oh. When you were fighting, because I know a lot of us don't spar anymore, but when you were sparring, what was your favorite technique?
Jeez, I think looking back, I think just a basic front kick seemed to, like as soon as people were leading in with whatever they were leading in, if you could time that and get your front kick in, it was always a good point. And funny enough, I remember the UFC was going for, say, 20 years. And then someone knocked someone out with a front kick, and they made this big deal about it. And who trained them to do that? And blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, that's not a new technique at all. And then people stopped using it for a while, and now they're using it again. And I'm like, that's just a basic technique that works. It's good. You've got your length, especially if you're the smaller, shorter guy. It was just a way of scoring a point. So I think that was my best one, because I could time someone coming in and doing it Yeah. And I, as I said, I thought it was funny that they're making a big deal about it in the UFC nowadays. And we were doing it back like 2 points.
Forever. Another one of those, Darren, that had a really nice high round kick.
I was actually going to say that was one of my favorites.
Because I remember when you were blue brown, man, you used to get fucking points on people with a fucking high round kick, and you'd hit them, and it's like, oh, it was nice.
But technically, it's easy to block. I don't know.
It is. If they see it. But yeah, okay.
Just 2 points to make, leveraging off what Darren said. One is, the UFC is, if you watch the history of how it progresses, anytime anything new
works,
that's a better idea. All of a sudden that becomes the rage. So it's interesting to watch how the UFC progresses relative to any individual thing that suddenly captures everybody's imagination. Having said that, Darren, one of the things I lament about my training is how little you and I got to fight. We never got to fight that together that often, and I really wish we had, because I respect you as one of the better fighters in the lexicon of my memory of people that I've trained with, but we never really got to fight that much.
Mitch, can I add one thing
memory,
to that?
My memories of Darren
is one tournament that I brought him to, and he had, shall we say, partied the night before.
Oh, I knew you were going to bring that up.
He went into the tournament and
Did he vomit on you?
Oh, no. He went into the fight and he went, oh, I got to end this quick. He walks in, bang, bang. Okay, there's 1 point. Does this round kick. Bam. Good. Goes back to the change room and goes, I don't want to fight again. But Darren, you won. Okay, fine. But he was fast, man. He had fast legs. He was great. It was,
and
I loved watching him spar.
That's the thing. I never got to experience actually fighting him. Okay, Bob, as a fighter, when you were sparring, favorite technique?
It was my left leg. A hopping in sidekick was my absolute favorite. And barring that, faking a middle level left leg kick and then trying to score with either a high round kick or a high hook kick.
Okay, I'm going to take this conversation back to the start, and we're going to go back to Darren again. So we're going to split this into two questions. First, your favorite kick, or your not kick, your favorite technique, and secondly, the technique that you scored the most with, if they're different.
Ooh, funny enough, I was actually thinking about that. I like the question mark kick, where you pretend to do a front kick and then go off to the head.
Yeah.
And I also used to like when you were heading in as if you were doing a lunge punch, and you switch it to a ridge hand around the head. Both of those I used to like to use on, say, I don't know, ranking belts. It didn't usually work in a tournament. So they were my favorite techniques, but they didn't work in a tournament because most people are kind of hip to that sort of thing. So
they won't get
what usually worked in a tournament was a reverse punch, because we did it so many times in class.
Exactly.
That was the kind of thing that worked, but it wasn't my favorite. It just worked. I would much rather the question mark kick, as they call it nowadays, but it's basically faking the front and going round was my favorite. But if you're hip to it, you can block it.
Bob, same question. Favorite technique and the technique that got you the most points.
Yeah, I mentioned my favorite techniques, and they didn't often get me the most points. I would have loved to have landed some more solid reverse punches. Just shuffle in reverse punch. But I don't remember a single instance of where it actually worked. And what's the question again? What worked?
What worked?
A fake high punch front kick to the body and a round kick to the head, which I
Man, you scored don't
remember
more points
working
on
all that often.
Round
I don't
kick
remember
to the
using
head
all
I can remember.
That often, to tell you the truth. Anyway, somebody else. Go ahead.
Okay, Rick, favorite technique and the technique that worked best for you?
Well, there's two. Block punch, man. Block punch worked for me in tournaments so much. It was like just block it and wow, reverse punch. It's such a basic thing, but I mean, these guys weren't doing it. I liked a bit of a rush, a bit of a, you know, boom, 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 and the third one gets in. That was my favorite, but what scored for most for me was probably block reverse. It works.
Lenny.
My favorite was a front leg sweep followed by a back knuckle over the top into his face.
Oh, nice, nice.
Oh, nice, yeah.
The thing is, a lot of tournaments that we go to now and that we went to in
won't
the past,
allow it.
That sweeps aren't allowed. That's unfortunate.
Sucks. Yeah.
It sucks, man.
It does suck. We teach
our five-year-olds get sweeping.
They're so wimpy now.
Yeah. that was my favorite. And the one that scored probably most for me was... similar to what Darren says, actually, a front leg kick, mainly to the liver.
Nice.
Which was a nice delayed reaction to watch.
Okay.
Mitch?
Yeah. Mitch. Lucky for me, the technique I like and the technique I score the most with are the same. And it's a shuffling in outside crescent kick with my left leg. And the reason I like it so much, I remember when I was a cue belt, I always loved the kicking aspect of karate. I thought it was really cool. I loved to kick. And my head instructor would always tell me, you're not a kicker. Stop doing that kick. I would try to work that crescent kick and I would always be berated for trying it because I'm not built like a kicker. I'm very top heavy. I don't have really long legs like Bob does. I'm not built like a kicker, but I really wanted to kick. And especially with that kick because I always thought it was kind of cool. So the reason it's my favorite kick is because it was the first time I decided I'm not going to listen to my head instructor. I'm going to work this kick until I can do it. And I did. So that's kind of why it's my favorite. And I think that goes hand in hand with why I scored the most with it. I think just the fact that I love to do it and I wouldn't not do it when I was in tournaments, whether I lost, and I lost a lot of tournaments. I lost at a lot of tournaments trying to work that kick because I couldn't do it very well. But after however long, blah, 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 it started working, blah, blah, blah. So that's the end of the story.
I found, from my perspective on that kick, I found it very intimidating and it sort of cleared the field. It sort of like a windshield wiper prevented anything but that technique in the skirmish and in that little.
And I have to... I have to concede that Bob's right because the actual technique that scored wasn't the crescent kick. It was the reverse punch that followed because Bob's right. It was, I used to call it a clearing technique. I don't know if that's an appropriate term, but it would be this technique that the kick would come across and it would generally open my opponent up for a reverse punch. Yeah. So that's kind of how I did it. Anyone we didn't get to on this?
No. Okay.
Okay, guys, we're going to go to one more question. We're going to jump to the sixth talking point, and we're going to limit it to, like, there's not much room for conversation here because we're running out of time, but it's an interesting question. If you had a chance to train either for a full camp or one session with a famous martial artist, now I'm going to hold us to that. It's got to be someone who's famous because that's how Len worded the question.
And I'm going first.
Of any style or era, who would it be and why? 30 seconds, Len.
Okay, I got to be selfish and say it's got to be two. One from pure martial arts is got to be Georges St-Pierre because I think he's just encompasses fabulous all-around knowledge, dedication, and he's just, for me, I think he's just amazing. Yeah, GSP, just not to do with the fact he's Canadian. but yeah, I just think he brought so much to mixed martial arts for so many styles. I just think he's amazing. And I can piggyback on the back of that, Mike Tyson, because I just think he's an absolute brute. And I'd say his training camp was just absolute beast. And I just love to train hard, physically hard, and be pushed hard. And I'd say his training camp would be amazing. There you go, 30 seconds.
I kind of split this up into three things because when you're growing up, the people that you want to train with are usually your idols. But then as you become proficient in your thing, they're not necessarily idols anymore. They're just realistic. So I took one, if I had one day or a training camp, do I want to learn or do I just want to be with someone that's an idol or do I want to have like lots of fun during the camp? So I thought if I wanted to actually learn stuff, I'd go with Eddie Bravo. I wanted to do something iconic, I'd go with Bruce Lee. If I just wanted to have a great laugh and enjoy a camp, it'd be a kind of a toss-up between Matt Serra or the Diaz brothers.
Matt Serra, yes. Really?
The Diaz brothers.
I think he's hilarious.
I can't stand the Diaz brothers.
Derek Lewis,
God.
Then, Darren. How about Derek Lewis?
I don't think he can teach.
But it'll be hilarious.
It'd be hilarious, but I don't think I'd learn fuck all.
Okay.
Nothing against Derek Lewis. If Derek's listening right now, nothing. That's not. I'm not saying anything better. Is he here? Is he here?
I would go back and I would do another thing with Superfoot Wallace because he.
Oh, I was going to say that, you motherfucker.
You and I went to his camp, man. He did some fantastic stretches. Now, I don't agree with his philosophy with fighting because he was only a left, whatever foot it was. Yeah. And that's all he did.
I identified with it because I'm a lefty too.
There you go. I didn't, but boom, boom, boom.
So am I.
But he had some fantastic stretches. And the other person, going to get a little sentimental here, I would really, really love to spend a day with my brother.
Oh, Jesus.
Oh, my God. Damn it. Break my heart, why don't you? Yeah. Jesus Christ.
You motherfucker. Hey,
I'd like to train with him. He had great kicks. He was fucking good, man. And
you know, really if like my brother would die, I'd want to trade with him, too.
Exactly. There you go. Anyway.
Note to self.
If all of you died, I'd want to trade with you.
To give Mitch's wish.
You know, Rick, I'm gonna give you kudos. That was that touched me. That's awesome.
That
breaks my heart a little bit.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. All right, Bob.
We talked about Superfoot Wallace. Oh, huh? Yeah.
Hell no. Wait, I'm still alive. Oh, goddamn it!
Right.
I don't know how famous he is to you guys, but to Mitch and me, he's famous. It's a judo world champion named Koga.
Yeah.
Look him up, man.
Holy fuck.
I'd love to have a seminar with that guy, but that's it for me. Yeah.
Nice.
Have we covered everybody?
Yep. You, Mitch. George Dillman.
Actually, no.
Yes.
It's that,
no. Oh, sorry.
No, it's
his brother. His brother, Dave.
It's
Dave Dillman.
Oh shit!
This is a tough one for me because I don't really idolize people. I idolize perspectives, and I don't know of any famous people who I can honestly say I understand their perspective enough that makes me want to train with them. So I'm gonna wuss out and go. Sorry, guys. I don't. All the people I want to train with are people I know. Because I understand them and I get them and I love their perspective on training. So I, given the parameter of the question with which is a famous martial artist, there isn't really anyone I want to train with.
I was just going to say, okay, for the sake of the question, let's say you had to pick someone and then just say, look, we're setting somebody up.
Fair enough.
Playing for the people, who are you going to train with? And then you pick someone.
I'll tell you. Oh, okay, fair enough. If I have to choose someone, I would pick Matt Hughes.
Matt Hughes? Oh, yeah. He was
Matt
good.
Hughes. The reason I would choose Matt Hughes is because I identify with him physically. He's kind of got the same build I had, like very thick in his upper body. He was extremely strong. I don't pretend to be anywhere near as strong as he was. I identified with how he fought. So it was a really poignant moment when George St. Pierre beat him for the welterweight title because I liked St. Pierre better as a person, but I identified with Hughes more as a fighter.
Nice.
So if I had to choose, I would have to choose Matt Hughes before he got hit by the train.
No mention of Chuck Norris, huh?
No. I don't.
No.
For the people listening, Mitch kind of physically resembles Chuck Norris.
Okay, folks, we're going to bring this one to a close. Let's go once around the table. Just final comments on anything we've talked about. Bob, what do you got?
Oh, Jesus Christ. All I can say is it's been a hoot. What else can I say? It's been fun talking, and we look forward to doing it again. And I don't have anything substantial to say about any of the actual topics. Oh, but we still got, like, 3 or 4 more things to go, talking points to do. So I look forward to that.
Rick, last comments.
As far as starting your journey as a black belt, I mean, it's a lifelong thing. You don't start your journey as a black belt. You start when you walk in the dojo. Black belt is a very large step, but it's a step. It's another step to what comes beyond, which you don't know what it is. As far as the refereeing, depends on who's refereeing, what's refereeing. I mean, you've got to bring strong centers. right? So if you don't have strong centers, you don't have a good tournament. I always thought my my block reverse punch was pretty good, and that served me well in many situations. So, it scored a few points. There you go.
Okay, Darren, last comments.
I don't really have anything to add because I think the topics weren't all related, so you'd have to go back to each topic and make a comment on it. So as far as the topics and everything, I have nothing to add. As a general podcast, once again, I relish everybody's opinion, and I walk away with a different opinion than I had when I started with. That's all I have.
Yeah, I mean, I sat down to do these points out, and as usual, we didn't get through them all. I didn't think they'd be as detailed and thought-provoking as they were, and I really enjoyed it. So I hope I didn't throw too many curveballs at everybody.
Anytime someone inputs into the questions we talk about, it's only a good thing. So, okay, folks, we're going to bring this one to a close. Thanks, guys, for being on the podcast again. You can't know how much I appreciate it. If you've got any comments or questions, please send them to my personal Facebook page, the No Mind Podcast Facebook page, or please send me an email at nomindpodcast2021@gmail.com. We're done. We're out. Thanks, guys.